So welcome to this Tuesday morning talk and this November meditation retreat at Jhana Grove. And as you've all been listening to me speak over the last 3 and a bit days, you know that I've encouraged you to take it easy, to rest if you need to rest, to work with your body rather than fight your body. But now the first 3 days are over. So really you should have rested pretty much by now. So usually if you are getting a bit tired and sleepy, it's still not absolutely certain, but there's more possibility that it's the sloth and torpor as a mental boredom rather than it is because you have to catch up on your sleep. So you'd expect, if there are such things as expectations, to have a bit more energy coming up, needing less sleep, and getting more interested in the nature of the mind and peace. But that's only a generalization, but in case you still are struggling with sloth and torpor, there is a few other little tricks of the trade. And some of those tricks of the trade are strategies for overcoming the dullness which arises in the mind. Understanding that in the path of meditation there does come a time when you're getting still and you have a choice. It's like a fork in the road. And you do have a choice to go on one path, which is into dullness, or into another path, which is still peaceful, but it has a little bit more energy into it. The one path is sort of comfortable and cozy, but very dull. And the other path is interesting, but you know, might be quite challenging for you. So you have that choice of which path to take. You're getting still. And can you maintain your interest and fascination, you know, with this beautiful path of peace? If that's the case, you can actually take that path. But in order to take that path and make it even more effective is actually to recognize that you have got that choice. And the simile which I used to give, which makes this very clear, is especially applicable to, you know, the dullness problem in meditation. And it was, came very much alive to me when 2 weeks ago I went to Wat Pa Phong with our president of Buddhist Society, Dennis Shepherd, and took him all around Wat Pa Phong, telling him the old stories of what happened here. It was like a nostalgia trip for me, and for Dennis Shepherd it was a nice way of him actually seeing, you know, the physical background to many of the stories he's heard many times. But one of the stories which came alive was when I showed him where the huts were in Wat Pa Phong, where we would stay, and where the, sort of the main hall was, where we would, you know, meditate and chant and listen to sermons in the evening. And he realized it was actually quite a long way. And I told him that at night time, you know, we'd walk back from the hall, you know, to our huts. And at many times that I didn't have a flashlight. Or rather, I had a flashlight, but there was no batteries. Because in those days, you know, it was a very poor monastery. I remember several times going to see Ajahn Chah and say, look, my flashlight has run out of batteries, can I have some more? He looked at me and there was real sadness. So we haven't got any batteries. There's none here. And so you just had to do without and use starlight or moonlight if you were lucky. Now remember, this was a monastery with snakes. And they were venomous snakes. And even, you know, you would say worse than that, they had these ants called the Mot Lin. And they were out there when Dennis was there. And I was very surprised and pleased at my reactions, because I could see them very quickly, you know, after sort of 9 years of being bitten by those, and then they hurt much more than bull ants in Australia. They've got a sting to them. They really sort of, you jump when they bite you. And so the instincts after about 26 years in Australia were still very sharp. And I noticed them straight away. My brain says, you know, be careful. So I stopped Dennis getting bitten by them as well, because they were all over the forest. So now remember, you had also no shoes, because the thongs which you had, they'd have break down very quickly. And you try and fix them up with all sorts of ingenious methods, but they'd all sort of fall apart. So you can imagine just at night time, walking back, maybe 5 or 10 minutes walk to your hut from the hall in the dark, no flashlight, no shoes, knowing there's all these things out there in the forest looking for their dinner and your toes with its evening meal. And snakes as well. But of course, I never got bitten by the snakes or the scorpions or the centipedes on the path. And there's a good reason for that. I knew they were dangerous. And because I knew they were dangerous, when I left the hall, even though there was hardly any light and I had no protection on my shoes, I was very alert, looking out for shadows on the path. And if I saw a dark shape across the path, there's no way of knowing whether that was a stick or just the shadow of one of the small saplings growing in the forest. But I couldn't take the chance. I saw it very quickly, because I was looking out for it, and I'd either jump over it or go by another route. And that's why I never got bitten. Most of those things probably were just twigs or just shadows in the forest, but I couldn't take the chance. And I was alert. I was never sort of thinking about, oh, what am I going to have for breakfast tomorrow morning? I was on the lookout for what was in front of me, totally mindful because of the danger. And that's why I could always avoid the problem. And I've used that simile for how we deal with meditation. Because each one of us has got what I call the major hindrance, the major problem which keeps on biting us in our meditation, which keeps on strangling us, using a simile of a python, so we can't go forward and deeper into our meditation practice. Each one of us has got our major hindrance. So how we use this, what I call the simile of a snake on the path, is when you start meditating, you settle down, and then you remember, what is my hindrance? What is the one I've really got to look out for in the next half an hour or an hour? What is the one which always keeps getting me and stops me getting deeper? So one, identify, you know, your most dangerous hindrance on this meditation session. What is it? Now, once you identify, you know, just say it's dullness. Dullness, it always gets me every time. So you say, I am going to be on the lookout for that dullness, so I can actually see it before it gets me. This is what I mean of identifying that fork in the path. And if you really set your mind up, you're going to be on the lookout for dullness. Then as you're meditating, you do get to that spot. You know, you're just about to get into dullness. You know that because you've done it many times before, but you see it before it gets you. And because you see it before it catches you, you can actually just go a different path or jump over it like I did with the snakes in the forest. You don't get bitten. Now, that is a very effective way of overcoming the dullness which just comes from boredom. Now, you know for a long time, you know, the boredom, that type of dullness, it's just not a pleasant state to go in. It's a waste of time. You know, you're sort of, you're missing out on much better pieces and happinesses and beauty and insights in the mind. So your job is to identify that hindrance, be on the lookout for it, and then you can avoid it very, very easily. Now, the other thing which sometimes comes up in this stage as a retreat is not dullness, but craziness. It's what I call the attack of all the hindrances. All at once, they gang up on you, the whole gang. And people have said that to me before, early on when I started teaching meditation. They said, I'm having a terrible time. So what's your hindrance? You know, is it sort of the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and then all of them? Add a few extras you've never heard of before. And I think you can always recognize what I mean there. And again, you develop another simile for how to deal with an attack of all the hindrance, all at once. You know, with a few extras which even the Buddha never heard of. And I use the simile from classic Buddhist story of the Buddha. And I've called it the Nalagiri strategy, and it's very effective. Now, for those of you who may have gone to a Buddhist Dharma school when you were young, or you've listened to some of the talks about traditional Buddhism, or you've read some of the stories about Buddhism, You may remember that one of the most celebrated stories in the life of the Buddha was towards the end of his life when someone was trying to assassinate him. So even if you're a Buddha, you still get your enemies. But anyway, somebody was trying to assassinate him. So what they did, they knew early in the morning the Buddha was going to go an arms round with his monks down the narrow streets of this city called Rajagaha. You know, it's modern-day Rajgir, but actually Rajgir is outside of where it used to be before. Some of you have gone on pilgrimage, you've gone to places like the Bamboo Grove or the Vulture's Peak, and you know, in that central part of that circle of mountains, that was where the great city of Rajagaha was. And so the Buddha was going on arms round, and if you go into sort of, you know, places like India, streets are very narrow, lined with houses on either side. So the Buddha was going on arms round with his monks, and so the person who was trying to assassinate him, they, you know, in the king's palace or wherever it was, they intoxicated one of the elephants. Basically, they fed him lots of alcohol until the elephant was mad and crazy with drunkenness. And then they let the elephant go along the path where the Buddha was coming. So basically, they wanted the elephant to sort of crush and destroy the Buddha. So you can imagine the scene, this huge elephant sort of charging down the road. And you know, elephants are, you know, huge and very dangerous when they're charging like that. And so people were jumping out of the way, they're going inside their houses, climbing over walls, climbing up trees. And as they were running away, they saw the monks coming and they warned them, "There's a mad elephant coming, get out of the way quickly while there's still time." And all the monks, apparently, even the great arahats, climbed the trees, jumped over the walls, ran into houses, all except two. And that was the Buddha himself. You know, he's not going to climb up any tree. And also his faithful attendant, Ananda. Now, if you read the story of the Buddha, you get some idea of the character of one of these important people in the time of the Buddha, Ananda. He's this very kind, sort of soft, you know, loving attendant. And basically he would do anything for the Buddha. He just loved to sit there and serve him. And that was his sort of character. But at that particular time he wasn't enlightened yet. So Ananda, he was not going to let his great master, the one he loved, just sort of die like this. So he moved in front of the Buddha. "Let the elephant kill me. I'm going to sacrifice my life for my master." And you see, understand what he was actually doing. But the Buddha pushed him aside. "Come on, Ananda, I can look after this." So poor Ananda lost his opportunity to give his life for the Buddha. But it was a very sweet act, but totally stupid. And so the Buddha was facing the great elephant charging down the road. There's just the two of them. A big elephant, mad, powerful, enraged against the beautiful, compassionate, peaceful Buddha. Who would win? And how would they win? Of course, you all know the outcome of the story. You know, the Buddha wins, because the Buddha always wins. You know, that's because we're Buddhists, I suppose. But anyway, what happened? The Buddha, you know, I have no doubt at all about the psychic powers of the Buddha. He was powerful, he was strong, he did have an incredibly powerful mind which could do, you know, magical things. I thought that the Buddha, if he wanted to, could have grabbed the elephant by the trunk and twirled him three times around his head and thrown him way on the other side of the Ganges over 300 miles away. But you don't do things like that as a Buddha. That's aggression, that's violence. So what the Buddha did, instead of fighting the elephant, he gave compassion to the elephant. In my words, the way I describe compassion, "Nalagiri, the mad elephant, the door of my heart is totally open to you. Whatever you do, I will always love and be kind to you. You can pick me up with your trunk and smash me against the wall. You can trample me with your feet. You can gore me with your tusks." Actually, have Indian elephants got tusks? They don't, do they? But it's a nice addition to the story. You can kill me, but I forgive you, because the door of my heart's open to you with unconditional love, no matter what you do. Now, you know me mention things like that, and I've encouraged those sorts of attitudes in you. Sometimes you've experienced the power of such unconditional opening the door of your heart and love. Imagine if a Buddha did that. 100% sincere, powerful. Nalagiri, trample me if you wish. Smash me if you wish. And with that degree of unconditional compassion, according to the story, within a second, the elephant had stopped in front of the Buddha and bowed his head, and the Buddha was stroking the elephant's trunk. There, Nalagiri, there, Nalagiri, there, Nalagiri. He subdued the enraged elephant with compassion, with kindness. And that's what we mean by the compassion and kindness. And that became a famous story, in the life of the Buddha. And I like to use those stories in the life of you, the meditator. Because in this simile, the mad, enraged, intoxicated elephant is your mind. Crazy, destroying everything in its path, smashing, trampling, goring. And that's what it's like sometimes. Your mind is crazy. You want to get people to keep out of your path. Otherwise, you might smash them or say something you'd regret afterwards. And sometimes your mind is like that. So how do you deal with a crazy mind? Not with aggression. Don't fight it. If the Buddha had fought the elephant would have fought back and killed the Buddha. Of course, the Buddha can't do that because he's a Buddha. So you don't fight the crazy mind. What do? Crazy mind, the door of my heart's totally open to you. If you want to drive me crazy, if you want to send me back to Singapore in an ambulance in a straitjacket, that's okay. If you want to kill me and destroy me, crazy mind, the door of my heart's totally open to you. I totally love and accept you no matter what you ever do to me. And if you actually love your craziness with unconditional acceptance, in a second or two, your crazy, stupid, psychotic mind will be bending in front of you and you're stroking it. There, mind, it's okay. Shh. It's okay. And that actually works. Because the power of like acceptance, it's not only powerful just because it's a force you don't understand. It's powerful because it undermines the force of craziness. If you fight craziness, if you don't like it, if you resist it, if you reject it, you feed it and make it stronger. But if you just accept it and make peace with it, and totally open your door of your heart to it, it vanishes. The source behind such craziness is removed. So that's why if ever you feel like you go absolutely crazy in this retreat centre, and your hindrances coming all over the place, come, let it come. Now I love you hindrances, I love you crazy mind. I'm sure that of all the minds and all the meditators in this room, that mine is the craziest. So just accept that and be at peace with it and love it. It's not true, of course, you're all as crazy as each other. Me included. But we just make peace with it. And that is a powerful way of overcoming these hindrances. So remember those two strategies which I introduced at this time of the meditation retreat. Dullness, simile of the snake, so you can actually avoid it before it really gets you. And craziness, just be crazy, who cares? Allow it to be. Don't fight it. Embrace it and accept it. And you find, just like Nalagiri, you're stroking your crazy mind and everything is at peace. And sometimes you get more peaceful that way than you do with just normal meditation. You've seen something, seen the obstacle, and you just go deep very quickly. But today I did promise last night to talk a little bit about the sweeping meditation. And by sweeping meditation, I don't mean the chores which Bianca has given you to sweep the floor here and sweep that. That's a really good sweeping meditation. Should we devolve that, Bianca? I think so, maybe. Keep everything nice and clean. But the sweeping meditation is just the way of learning how to relax your body. And it's a very good meditation because you can feel immediate results and because you're learning a technique which you can apply to your mind. Now, I said a couple of days ago that really there's, you know, all types of meditation are basically the same. There's only one type of meditation, which is calming the mind so it becomes bright and clear. You can see things as they truly are. It's just a matter of calming and seeing clearly. That's what meditation is. But there's many different ways of doing that. And the wonderful thing about the sweeping meditation is it encourages the mindfulness, the awareness, together with compassion. Now these are the two qualities which are very, very important, you know, in your practice here. It's not just being mindful, it's being kind. Kind to your body, kind to your mind, kind to everything which is in this monastery, kind to your fellow meditators, kind to Bianca, kind to me, kind to the flies, kind to everything, even the things which crawl in your toilet bowl or whatever. Everything be kind to, with mindfulness. And if you can develop a huge strength of compassion and put that together with a huge strength of mindfulness, you've got an incredibly powerful mind, and that will be able to do huge amounts of progress in your meditation. So how we develop that on our body is that we start to experience regions of our body one by one in methodical order. So the way that I've taught and practiced this is I start by feeling my toes. Closing my eyes, I ask myself, are there any sensations there in my toes? I use the furthest part of my body from my head, because I know that having been trained as a Westerner, you stay in your head most of the time, and the furthest part of your body, you know, your toes, hardly get any attention at all. In fact, going back to my memories in Wat Pa Phong in Thailand, the Westerners, because we wouldn't wear shoes, because we didn't have any, we were always stubbing our toes on rocks or trees. And when Ajahn Chah saw our feet, they were always patched up with bandages and with band-aids. And he couldn't believe it, you know, because the Thai monks, they never had so many cuts and bruises and stubbed toes. And he said, you Westerners have got stupid feet. And that's a wonderful way of looking at it. Because I never thought that feet could be stupid, but they were right. My feet were stupid because I wasn't aware of what was going on down there. It was up in my head. When I was walking, I was thinking about the 12 links of dependent origination and sort of the final points of the Eightfold Path. And I was totally unaware of what my feet were doing, just like everyone else. That's why he kept stubbing them and treading on things you shouldn't have trod on. So he told us to have more wise feet. So I start with my toes and I get to know them. So I just ask myself, are there any feelings down there? And if you can't notice any sensations, just wiggle them or touch them. You know, with your eyes closed, so you can actually feel a sensation somewhere around your toes. Now, once you can feel that sensation around your toes, that's what we call contact is made between your mind and your toes. Now you're mindful of your toes, you've got a sensation down there. Now once you've got the contact, like, you know, you've called up a friend, the next thing is you send compassion down there. You know, I haven't looked at you for a long time, toes. You okay down there? Everything all right? Anything you want? And you send kindness down there and compassion. And what actually happens is you feel your toes relaxing. When I first tried this, I never realized tension could be in your toes and that you can actually relax the toes. You can. I always thought, yeah, you can relax your shoulders, you know, you can relax your back, but relaxing toes, I never heard that one before, but you can. You actually feel the sensations change. There's a certain tightness there and now it relaxes and you can notice with your awareness, sensations change and you feel it's going more towards what you recognize as relaxation and ease. You take that as far as you can, now you may be about 2 minutes, 3 minutes, until your toes are as relaxed as you can make them. It's amazing, you do that with kindness, with compassion. In the same way that you may be sort of really tight and upset, and you may go and see your mother. If you haven't got a mother, you come to see me. And just without touching, you say, there, it's okay, everything's alright, never mind, it's pretty good. No, you're going crazy, especially go crazy here than back at home, because you know you can be okay over here, we'll look after you. The kindness and compassion which you know, I try and give you in interviews and other times, it settles you down and you relax more. Compassion works. It does relax and bring you to a greater sense of ease. Your tension, your tightness opens out with compassion. So your toes feel that. And once your toes are relaxed after 2 minutes or 3 minutes, you move up to your feet. The soles, the uppers, the heels, anything in your feet. And you ask yourself, is there any sensation down there? And once you can feel a sensation, then you send kindness there. To see how much you can relax your feet. And again, this is what I mean. After a while you get wise feet, you can get sensations down there. You can look after them. I don't know how you've got your feet put now, but I just recognised when I started talking about them, you know, my right foot is jammed under my leg. If I carry on like this, it's going to start hurting. I never recognised that until a second ago. So now, out of kindness. Right, there you go. Alright? Yeah, good. When you're kind to your feet like that, they really relax, they respond. And the whole area starts to tingle with a special feeling we call relaxation. The whole thing opens out, tensions are relieved. And your feet relax. After they relax as much as possible, then you go to your ankles. I like to spend some time with these joints, because the joints do a huge amount of work. Just imagine just how much weight you are, and all that is transferred or held up by these very narrow ankles. They get a lot of pressure. So you spend some time, just what can you feel in your ankles? Any sensation there? Look, be kind to them. And just will them to relax and relax and relax with kindness, with compassion. And when you can feel that area relaxing, whatever you put attention to and whatever you put compassion to, it changes things. And then once your ankles are relaxed, just a couple of minutes each place, then you go to the calves of your leg. Now I can feel my calves, because I was walking. They're sort of a bit tired, this sort of tightness there, which happens when you're walking. So you relax those. You feel the sensations. Send kindness, compassion. There you go, calves. And the whole thing relaxes. And you feel this beautiful sense of comfort. Perhaps the best simile of that type of comfort which you feel is when you first wake up in the morning, in bed. It's not too early. You feel so cozy and comfortable, and you don't really want to get out of bed. If it wasn't for the breakfast, you probably would still be in bed. So you feel this beautiful comfort and ease in the sort of the calves and other parts of the legs. And once that's there, go to the next place, your knees. And because maybe like Australians play a lot of sport, or because that you go running around or playing, falling off motorbikes or whatever, people have huge amounts of injuries in their knees. And especially now you guys, you've been meditating cross-legged, and that's not such a natural position for your knees. You get aches and pains in there. So there might be some tension in there somewhere. So experience any sensations and feelings in your knees. With your eyes closed, what's going on down there? Yeah, I can get a sensation there. It's not so bad, but it's a bit tight. And I send kindness there. So my whole attention is just with my knees, focusing on that area. With gentleness and being kind. And then I feel that the whole sensation starts to relax. And after a couple of minutes, the knees feel really good. And my thighs, these huge strong muscles, which you use more than anything else for motoring your body backwards and forwards. And they do a huge amount of work. So I ask myself, any sensations I can notice in my thighs? Once I notice them, that's called contact. I establish contact first of all, and then once I have a sensation, I've got a means of sending kindness. I send compassion, kindness to all my thighs, anything which I can feel down there, I ease. I can imagine sensations expanding. You can imagine like the muscles like being pulled, and I just release the tension, or things being squashed, and I expand them to free them. Any tightness, any tension, I imagine like that, and I can relax it. And after a couple of minutes, everything's just so nice. Then even when you're sitting, you imagine your bottom, your buttocks, and what sensations are there. And if you actually ask, you find, yeah, you may have a few bits of folds of clothing sort of cutting into your flesh, or you may not be properly adjusted on top of the chair, on top of the cushions. You feel that. And once you've got sensations there, you do something about it. You know, you just fidget a little bit. Get yourself nice and comfortable. And if you can't do that, you just send kindness there. And even without fidgeting, just paying attention to the sensations in your buttocks and sending kindness there, you can actually relax them. You didn't realize how much tightness and tension can be there. Now sometimes, what's it called, anal retentive or something, they crush themselves up around the buttocks and anus. You relax, but not too much. If you really want to relax, up the toilet, but don't know. But you know what I mean. Just relaxing enough. And once your buttocks are nice and calm and peaceful and tingly and just nice, you move up to your waist. Now, the reason I started my toes, because the area of your legs, yeah, it's important, but you know the real business is up here between my top of my head and my, my anus. This is where most of the aches and the pains and the illnesses and sicknesses lie. But by the time I've worked up to here, I've been developing mindfulness and compassion all the time. So when I get up to here, it's usually pretty strong, my mindfulness and compassion. So I start looking at my sort of my guts, my colon, and any other sort of organs which are around that area of the waist. So it could be your lower back if you've got back pain. So I feel anything, what's going on down there? Anything needs some kindness? And it might be sort of, my guts. You know, maybe because, I've got wind or I ate too many baked beans this morning or whatever, I don't know. And you feel that sensation and you just accept that sensation. So you make contact with it and then you send it kindness. You relax it. And just with practice, like anything else, it's amazing just how you can relax feelings of indigestion, feelings of pain, any sensations which are there. You can relax everything. And then you move up to, I like to go to that space lower than my chest, above my waist, sort of in this middle portion here. Because in there is your upper intestines, it's what livers and kidneys and goodness knows what else there. You don't have to know sort of the anatomy of your own body. You don't need to be a medical student. Just know there's something there. You can feel sensations there. Once you know those sensations, send them kindness. So even if you've got sort of a kidney pain, notice it and then send it kindness. And you can actually relax it a huge amount. I remember there's one of our monks over in our monastery, many of you would know him. Many years ago, he told me he was in big trouble because he had chronic back pain. And he went to see his GP and they did some tests and they found out it was something congenital. And they said, well basically, you can't do anything about it. You just have to bear with it. Which wasn't much fun if you like meditating. And fortunately, he came across a little book and it told him how to be mindful of the muscles around his spine. And there's a wonderful little exercise which he did, which he told me about. He said, first of all, he used his fingers to feel those muscles, to basically to stroke them, so he can get some idea of what those muscles were. until you can actually feel those muscles without touching them. Now, you and I probably can't even notice those muscles because they're not really important for us. But by touching them and by getting some more mindfulness to them, literally he was making neural connections in his brain to that muscle area. He's becoming conscious of them. And once he became conscious of them, the next step was actually to be able to move them at will, to stretch them, to relax them. And once he could do that, then he could exercise them. You know, just by will, stretching, just the same as I move my shoulder, move it down again, because I can do that, because I've got awareness of my muscles in my shoulder. Now he's got that same awareness in the muscles on the other side of his spine, and he exercised them until they became strong enough through exercise to compensate for the weakness of his spine. Problem solved. It was a brilliant sort of little method. But I liked it just because it just showed you there's many muscles and organs and stuff in your body which you don't know about because you don't have to, because you've got no mindfulness there, you know, that you can't do anything about them when they need your help. So it's like, you know, just getting sort of the telephone numbers of the important people or getting their email numbers, so when you actually need them you can actually contact them. This is getting your email number of your kidney. Know, by contacting them and getting to know them and getting that connection, which means that any time they really need your help, you've either got your number, you can pay attention there, and you can send them compassion, kindness, and relax everything. So and after that part of the body, you stay there relaxing everything. Everything tingles, feels nice. Then you go up a bit. Now this is where the women really get interested. Is it about 30% of women will get breast cancer? What's the number? It's a huge amount. I don't know what the number is, but it's a huge problem. Is it 10% or 20%? Who knows the number? 1 in 10% will get breast cancer. So, how many women on this retreat? 5 or 6 of you? So this is important stuff, okay? So pay attention. So when you get to this area of the body, you feel any sensations. Now, it doesn't have to be in your breast, it can be just in your sort of lungs or whatever else is going on up there. You feel any sensations there. And once you get to know those sensations, send it kindness to relax everything. And it'd be great to do some research on this, but I'm pretty confident in the way I know the nature of the mind's interaction with the body. Anyone who does this method and does it regularly and has the opportunity to relax their own parts of the body, especially women with their breasts, you probably feel little tensions in those breasts and you relax them and relax them and relax them until they totally disappear. And I'm pretty sure your incidence of breast cancer will be far lower than any other human being. Because you're doing something about it. So not only is this going to actually help you with your health, it's also you're going to get to that point and you're going to know about mindfulness and compassion. Relax everything. We all know that most sicknesses are stress related, and stress means tension. Sometimes you don't know how to release the stored up tensions in our body. This actually does it for you. Methodically you're working up, by the time you get to this area, you should have enough mindfulness and strength of kindness. You can just look at something and just relax it straight away. And by relaxing, you know what I mean? This is being tight, this is being relaxed. You know what that feeling is like? You have that feeling in your breasts, in your backbone, everywhere. And you move out to your shoulders, I'll do that next, and relax those, because you know, we all like shoulder massages because so much tension is there. So relax everything down there, then I just go down my arms, the upper arms. Sometimes I use the elbows, sometimes I just go to the lower arms, the wrists, the hands, 2 minutes each. And once the hands are just really relaxed, there's lots of sensations, lots of nerve endings in your hands, so you can feel them. Now relax. And everything gets just so nice and comfortable. Again, that feeling like when you just wake up in the morning, just really so cozy, so nice. One of the most pleasant bodily feelings of the day. And then I go back up to my shoulders again and go to my neck, from the neck to the head, the face usually, because in the face again it's a place of lots and lots of tension. I just feel the face, any sensations there. Once I can find a sensation, I send it kindness. You know what happens when you give kindness to your face? You get this beautiful, kind smile. That's a sign that you have relaxed your face. And it feels beautiful. And last of all, it's a bit of a trick. I go to 2 inches behind my eyes, to my brain. People tell me there are no sensations in your brain. There's no nerve endings there. That's nerve startings, not endings. But nevertheless, you can imagine a sensation in your brain. And I relax it. I extend it kindness. And the whole brain feels like it's relaxing, opening out. All those tensions of compulsive thoughts, all that pain of negativity which, you know, has its reaction in my brain, it all tends to relax. And the brain sort of calms down and settles. And it feels like it's relaxing as I'm sending compassion and kindness together with mindfulness to my own brain. And after I do this for maybe half an hour, the whole body is just so relaxed. And I've been setting up mindfulness and compassion for such a long time. And I finish off with my brain. And then I just make that next step to my mind. I'm mindful of my mind. And I send it kindness. There you are, mate. Relax. And you go to these beautiful, still meditation states. Because your brain and your mind has got a connection there. And just going from one to the other very easily means that you've taken the mindfulness and compassion and then you're doing it to your mind. Breath, beautiful. Soon settles down. Because just as you've given kindness to your body, you've just gone into the habit for half an hour. You can't help it but being kind to your breath. And the whole thing just relaxes. And even your breath is just like the feeling when you first wake up in the morning, tingling, just so nice. You just don't want to move away from your breath. And it just relaxes and you go into some deeper meditations. So that's the meditation on sweeping the body. If you do it every time, you get bored again. Because what you repeat time and time again, just the body doesn't engage with. So just do it every now and again. It's a nice little one to do. And especially if you're really concerned about your health, it's great doing that once a day or something, a little bit of sweeping. It is especially helpful for those people who have a hard time going to sleep at night. Because if you're laying down in your bed, sometimes people don't go to sleep at night because they worry so much about all the terrible things which are going to happen to you tomorrow morning. Or you think is going to happen to you tomorrow morning. All the problems of today you haven't figured out yet. So a lot of time it's tension in the mind. But sometimes you might try counting sheep or relaxing. But still the body doesn't go asleep. And the reason for that is because there's tension in the body. And if there's tightness in the body, it's very difficult to go to sleep. Now, there's a sort of an underlying tightness and tension there which doesn't allow the mind to relax into sleep. And that particular tightness in the body, that sort of, it is a pain, but sometimes you just can't recognize it because it's just constant. It's there as a tightness which won't allow you to let the body go. That really does respond to that sweeping meditation I just taught. So if you're in the bed there and you know, you've got not too many worries, but the body is tired or it's tense because you've been working too hard or whatever, start with your toes and relax them to the max. Just as I said, maybe a minute, feet, minute, ankles, calves, knees, just relaxing and feeling the beautiful relaxation sweep up your body. And most people who try this, they don't get to the bottom before they go fast asleep. Just the whole idea of relaxing the body takes away that tightness, then the obstacle to your sleep is gone. And I was very fascinated at a conference of Australian counsellors and psychologists who were Buddhist. One of the people there just talked to me afterwards and said, I'm making a fortune out of this. Because she started a little company in Sydney. She told me it's website is called sleeplikeababy.com. then all of the advice he's given is just exactly the meditation I've just taught you just about. And people are just applying to her because they can't sleep, they've got insomnia. She teaches them this meditation. And she told me, she said 100% success rate in this. And she's making a fortune. I'm undercutting her market by teaching it for free. But it's very powerful. If you can't go to sleep at night, just relax the whole body and you're fine. You go to sleep very quickly. So that's a sweeping meditation. And its importance is it establishes mindfulness together with compassion. I know in much therapies and psychology these days, they've got mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. They use mindfulness a lot in psychology. Of course, it comes from Buddhism, but we don't care because, you know, however it works, whoever makes it work, we're happy with that because it lessens human suffering and that's what we're about. Not making more Buddhists, but lessening people's pain. So, there is a problem with it though. And that problem became very clear at another conference I went to in Sydney, where this, I remember his name, Professor Philip Golden from, what's the University of Palo Alto? What's that university called? Stanford University. Now, one of the great universities, you know, of the world. He told me he did an experiment, because there's lots of money available for, like, you know, meditation research. And he said he got the money from his university to do some research. He got, you know, his psychology students, and apparently that if, you know, you're doing a degree in psychology and you volunteer for some of these research projects, you get credits, you know, which count towards your degree. So, you know, it's actually worthwhile, you know, just volunteering for these experiments. And so, if you're doing an experiment, you've got to sort of compare things. And that's actually how they get an understanding of what works, what doesn't. So you wanted to find out how much meditation relaxes you. So he sent half of the volunteers, you know, students, he sent them to a meditation retreat for one day, a mindfulness meditation retreat, a vipassana. And the other half he sent, again, all for free, to a Californian spa for the day. You know, massages, hot baths, you know, stones on your back, pouring hot oil over you, being pampered to the max all day. And you wanted to find out who is the most relaxed at the end of the day. The ones who did the meditation or the ones who went to the spa. And it was very clear when he published the results, the people who went to the spa were far more relaxed than the people who have gone to the mindfulness class. And, you know, it's obvious why, because that was a mindfulness which had no kindness and compassion. The spa, compassion all day. Just relax. And people looking after you and pampering you. Of course you get more relaxed that way, because kindness is what is the missing ingredient from the mindfulness courses. And that's why in this retreat, you know, you think, Ajahn Brahm, you're so soft, you're too soft. No. This is the path which works. Mindfulness plus kindness. And if those two work there, then I'm sure if Professor Golden had an experiment with you guys and you really were doing your mindfulness and compassion here, then you would be far more relaxed in the spa. I guarantee that, especially after you get the bill from the spa. They're really expensive. So that's the combination of mindfulness with compassion. And I don't mind talking about that, this particular meditation, because this follows the theme of the whole retreat here. Be aware, but be kind. And sometimes at this stage you know it's not really being kind to you again to sleep too much. It's just too much, you get dull and bored. And so sometimes it's the time to sort of try and get some interest and energy going up. And if you can't get interest and energy going up just sitting here, you know, spread your wings a little bit. Sit outside in your hut. find nice little quiet places, go for a walk in the forest, listen to the sound of the birds. Come on, birds. Thank you. Or listen to the silence. Now just see the flowers and the trees. Investigate the barks on the trees. Get some interest, which is being kind, compassionate, and being interested in what's around you. And that actually gets energy coming up. It is a beautiful place. And we have to have meditation retreats in a beautiful place, because the quietness of the mind which you generate during meditation can very easily lead to dullness. So you need something to inspire you, to inspire without exciting. And that's why we have nature. It's like that. It inspires, but it doesn't excite you. It's just the right level of energy producing. So, just watch the sunset. Watch the dawns. It's a great time of the year right now, because there's a few clouds on the horizon, but not too many. It makes beautiful dawns this morning. Or wonderful sunsets. So enjoy those. Get inspired by them. Get the energy up. And that means, you're being kind to yourself, and you're also being mindful. And with that inspiration, that energy, that increases sort of your power. Never forget inspiration. And so if there has been a really nice talk, if there has been so much you've done which has been really wonderful, you had a good meditation, great! Be inspired by it. Be energized by it. And then that empowers your mindfulness. For those of you who are devout Buddhists and been a Buddhist a long time, you just might look at the Buddha statue and just think, wow, it's amazing what that person actually did. What an incredible thing that was. And you get really inspired. Now you have the chance, you've made it as a birth as a human being. You're fit and healthy, you've met sort of Buddhism, and you've actually got to this stage, you're actually in a meditation retreat. This is not quite as good as it gets. If you want to go to the next stage, wear brown. This is as good as it gets, isn't it right, sister? Yeah, this is as good as it gets. But you're, just almost on the same level, just a tiny bit less. But you're meditating, you're here, you've got a chance to really get your mind into freedom. Wow, this is amazing what you've done. Well, you get inspired that so many of you just contributed to this meditation retreat center. All that hard work which you have done, look what's happened. People are here getting great meditations, becoming alive because of all of you. Wow, that really is great, good karma. So you inspire yourself, and that gives you lots and lots of energy. And when you get lots and lots of energy, look what I'm doing. And look what we did here, we ordained bhikkhunis, changing the face of Theravada Buddhism in our world, in today's world. Wow! You get inspired, you get energized. And don't downplay that inspiration and energy. That's why if you ever are dull, you sit down, what have I done? Think of all the amazing things which you've achieved so far. All your kindness, all your generosity, all the wonderful things which you have done. You think like that. You close your eyes. And soon, just you get incredible amounts of joy and bliss, you might even start crying. Wonderful. And after the tears are finished, you just go on to the breath. Oh, it's so nice. Yep. And you're on the way. Inspiration empowers the mindfulness. Inspiration in the Dhamma, the teachings you've heard, inspiration in the Buddha, inspiration in all your kindness, and all your generosity, all your forgiveness, all the stuff you give. And don't downplay that. Trouble with Westerners, it's all nothing at all. I just do this because I like it. No, you're doing immense things. Look at Bianca over there, just how much she helps and serves this place. She remembers that her mind will be off into the jhanas, the express train, because all of the good karma she's done. all of those people who have served and helped, you know, it's almost like someone gives you a first class ticket. Singapore Airlines suites for you all the way to Nirvana. Because you've done really wonderful things. Be inspired, be uplifted. And then you don't get depressed, you don't get dull. Wow. And I mentioned this to my monks. You probably would know this as well, that how much I travel, how much I work, teaching all over the place, and sometimes say, how on earth can you do that without getting exhausted? And that's what I do. You're coming off from... I just had a trip to Thailand. What did I do to get to Thailand? Leaving Saturday afternoon, getting there Sunday lunchtime, and starting the journey back on Monday morning at 5 o'clock in the morning. Just going there, spent about 6 or 7 hours in Ubon, and back to Perth again, in time to give the Friday night talk. All this crazy stuff. How I do that is just, you know, you think, you know, in the aircraft, what have I done? I think, wow, that's really good. Oh yeah, that's really wonderful. I really actually helped somebody. Oh yeah. And when you celebrate your generosity, your goodness, your kindness, and you've all got heaps of it, it brings energy. With mental energy, Sloten Torpa Dhammas hasn't got a chance. Doesn't matter how tired you are, how hard you've worked, how little sleep you've had. Whoa, yeah. You get energy. So don't forget inspiration also as a means. Inspiration not just in other people, inspiration in your own actions, in your own goodness, in your own purity. You being part of something wonderful. When you have that inspiration, you're away. So this is especially for the three sisters here. Just what you've done becoming bhikkhunis will reverberate throughout the world in history. It's an amazing thing you've done, incredible good karma. Use that, exploit that. In this meditation retreat. Wow. You're on the sweet class to Nirvana. And it works. So that's the talk today about sweeping meditation, overcoming the big hindrances of dullness and craziness, and using inspiration to energize your mind without exciting it. Happy meditating. Any questions anyone has before we go off to interviews? Okay, so this is a nice part of the retreat. Enjoy it to the max. Squeeze as much joy and inspiration out of today as you possibly can. The place is yours. Squeeze everything out of it. Okay.